Accession number 30649, Mr. Ted Hill, Reel 2. Now, we're talking about your time living in March during the war years. Any other memories that bring back the sort of what it was like to be a nipper, you know, 7 to 13 during the war years?
Well, I mean, it didn't affect us a terrible lot. I mean, there was lots going on around. We used to see all the soldiers and army convoys used to go through March, and they used to come through on the railway. And most people in March knew, well, they worked for the railway, so they knew what was going on. And they would, word would quickly go round if the Royal train was coming through or if an army train was coming through. And we'd all go, I was about, I don't know, quarter of a mile from the railway between March and Peterborough. And if the Royal train was going to Sandringham, it used to come via Peterborough in March, and we'd go and see it. Because they always went to the Sandringham on the train in those days. And we used to go down to see the army trains, you know, hundreds of tanks on trains. We used to see troops shouting out the windows at all us kids lining the side of the railway. But we used to, I mean, there was so much freedom for us in the country in those days. We used to range all over the place, swimming down in the river, which was about a quarter of a mile from my house. But sometimes we used to go to a place which we called Botany Bay, which was about 4 miles on our bikes through the country with hardly any traffic. In those days, we used to cycle there with a picnic for swimming. And it was a great place to grow up in, actually, the country, even in wartime. I mean, we used to lay and count the aeroplanes and argue what they were, fortresses or whatever. And I remember during the war, when they did the bridge too far, when they landed at Arnhem, they assembled over the fens, the aeroplanes towing the gliders. They seemed to assemble over the fens and form up in columns, and off they went. And the air was total noise, you know. It was a noise you've never heard before, because, I mean, aircraft engines are not silenced. And there was hundreds and thousands of aeroplanes in the air. And the noise was just continuous for hours. They're the sort of things I remember about the war. There was no hardship that I recall. You know, evacuees used to tell us about, you know, how bad it was in London in those days. But it wasn't for us in the country, although we were bombed a few times.
Now, what about when the war was coming to an end? Do you remember any V-Day street parties or VJ-Day street parties?
We didn't have street parties that I remember, but we had, where I lived, the council houses were in a large U shaped by Wisbeach Road, Pease Hill Road, which went round in a U shaped, and in the middle was like a recreation ground. But it was just a field with a sewer thing at one end. But it was our play area. I mean, later after the war, when I joined the Navy, they did make it a proper recreation ground and put swings and all that in. But in those days, it was just a field. And I remember as the war was coming to an end, that we started collecting some things and made a giant bonfire in the middle of this field, which was enormous. I mean, I remember it must have been about 15 or 20 feet high, because in the end, farm tractors were coming in with a trailer was loaded with old tree trunks and wood, and waste oil was poured on the top, and we had a gigantic bonfire. And when it went down...
That was on, 8th of May?
Yeah, that was... When it went down to... embers, people sat around with drink and roasting potatoes on the embers. We didn't have no drink at our age, but we had plenty of roast potatoes.
Now, after the so you then life goes on, you know, and you're still at school. Now you leave at 14, so that would be 1946.
Yeah.
Now, what were you going to do? Because you couldn't join the Navy at 14, or you didn't anyway.
I wanted to be an engineer.
Why? If you see what I mean, you know.
Well, my father was an engineer, and he used to make everything around the house and the garden, his allotment. I mean, things like seed planters. I always remember he got a round tobacco tin and drilled holes around it at a set distance and screwed it onto a round piece of wood on a handle, and he'd put seeds in it and run it along the row and it'd drop a seed out. That was the theory at spaced interval. And it did work. And he used to make things like that all the time. And I used to help him on occasions. So I always wanted to be an engineer. I didn't particularly want to go on the railway because you had to start off as a cleaner. You know, cleaning railway engines and all that. But basically, he was just a cleaner. And then later, you became an assistant fireman and then a fireman. And after about 20 years, you may become a driver. It seemed all too long for me at 14. Whereas if I went in an engineering firm, I would be doing engineering from day one, albeit at a very low level. But a firm opened up near me, a local man, a family called the Johnsons. He invented a potato digger that would dig, clean, separate the tops, grade the potatoes in sizes and put them in bags all on this one big machine. So they opened a factory building these machines, which was quite near me, and I got a job there.
What as?
An assistant fitter and turner. Well, an apprentice fitter and turner.
A proper apprentice?
Yeah.
With an apprenticeship?
Yeah. And I was in the machine shops mainly. I used to go with the fitters on occasion as fitters' mates under training, you know.
So you started in 46.
Yeah.
And how did you enjoy that?
It was great. Sixpence an hour I started on. Old money, which is what, about 2.5p now in our modern currency. But it was, I got about 25 shillings a week, which was a lot of money for a 14-year-old. Mind you, at school, we could, in the summer, have blue cards, which gave you 6 weeks off school to work on the farms. But my parents would never let me do that. So I had to go to school all the time. When I started in engineering, there was no day release anywhere, because there was nowhere to go. Actually, so all the training was within the company, and I did it for what, 3 years, and I really enjoyed it
till 49,
and I was getting the urge. My brothers were both in the Navy, coming home in their uniforms, you know, and I got the urge to go in the Navy.
Now, what was it, just your brothers or adventure, or what in particular prompted you?
Well, I knew eventually that when I was 18, I would be called up National Service. Well, 18 or 20 when you finish your apprenticeship, I would be called up, and I would probably go in the army, because most people did. if you wanted to go in the Air Force or the Navy, you had to volunteer. So I volunteered. There was a bit of hassle with the company because I was an apprentice, but in the end they allowed me to go because I was going in the armed forces in the engineering department. I joined as a stoker, a junior stoker actually. I was a boy because I was only 17, just 17, and they let me go, and I joined the Navy in the 5th of April 1949, and went through the usual.
Now, how did you actually go about joining? I mean, what happened? I mean, was any palaver or tests or the rest of it?
Oh, yeah. I had to get my father's permission and signature, and his signature had to be witnessed by some person in authority, and he got the postmaster in March to witness his signature, and we both had to be there. Then I had to go up to Cambridge. The Navy sent me a travel warrant, and I went up to Cambridge and sat some tests.
What type of tests? Just sort of general intelligence or psychometric?
Yeah, English, arithmetic, and mechanical. And the mechanical part was they showed pictures of various tools and you had to name them and what they were for, which I passed with flying colours because I was, you know, in the trade. And then I went back and had a letter of acceptance.
What about a medical?
Oh, yeah.
How strict?
Very strict. That was at Cambridge as well. I had to go back another day. After I'd passed these tests, I went back for a medical and passed that okay. And then I just waited.
You would only be you'd only be 16 then. Yeah. Not 17.
Yeah.
Now, where were you called up to go?
Initially I had to report to the recruiting office at Charing Cross on the day with about 30 or 40 others, and we were all taken by a naval chief petty officer who took us on the train down to HMS Royal Arthur, which was in Corsham in Wiltshire, and we did 8 weeks military training, marching, rifles and all that sort.
Now, what were your first impressions when you got to Corsham, well, to Royal Arthur? You know, because when you arrive, you're a civilian, well, a boy, so and then you go through the gates and essentially you're not very quickly. How did they manage it? What happened to you when you, if you remember? I mean, it's a long time ago.
Well, I remember everything was organised. You didn't walk anywhere, you marched as a group, even in civilians. They started us when we all went in the gate, they lined us up, left turns and all that, and marched us in. The next day, we were uniformed.
Now, what do you remember about kitting out? What did they kit you out with?
Everything.
What, do you remember what it was, though? Because it's all changed now, of course.
Oh, yeah. Well, two blue uniforms. We wasn't issued with white uniforms then. We were issued with number eights, which was a blue shirt and, like, jean trousers, similar to jeans. Two of those. Two pairs of overalls, a pair of boots, no, two pairs of boots, one working and one best, socks, underpants, vests, you know, all the normal gear that you needed. Tropical gear was issued later if you were going abroad.
to sew it in later, or was it just a stamp? Just stamp was good enough. Now, what about your accommodation? Where were you staying then? Well, all of them.
Well, that was a bit of a culture shock because we were in blocks, long blocks. I mean, I don't remember.
Were they huts or barracks? If you know what I mean.
Barracks. Single story barracks. But there must have been 40 or 50 bunks, double bunks, you know, an upper and a lower metal frame bunk. There must have been 40 or 50 in this, you know, long, long room with all the facilities, one end, bath and toilets, showers and toilets.
Oh, yeah. We had to have lockers for our kit and our personal civilians, which usually are sent home. But we were so near Easter leave. I was in the Navy, I think, for 10 days. And went on Easter leave. And it was so quick. We'd been issued with everything, all our uniforms, which we had to wear. And in those days, there was an old edict still around that if you wanted to wear civilian clothes on leave, you were supposed to get permission, believe it or not. But because we didn't. I mean, we wore civilians when we got home, or half our uniform, or something to show we were in the Navy. But we were issued and had this leave so quickly, we didn't get our branch badges, which was a propeller.
As a stoker?
As a stoker, yeah. Now, they were unique to stokers, a propeller in those days. It covers many branches these days, but in those days, it was stokers, stoker mechanics, leading stoker mechanics, petty officers and chief petty officers were the only ones who wore a propeller. And we didn't get ours, so we went home as seamen with no badges.
Now, if we look through a typical day during this, I know this is military training, basic training, but we look through a typical day, we'll get lots of things over. So how would your day start at Royal Arthur? About what time?
Oh, it was about 7 o'clock. Reveille. You got up, washed, dressed, and breakfast would probably be about 7:30. And we would be marched to the breakfast place. And I think we could make our own way back.
Now, what was the food like generally? We'll take all three meals or whatever at once rather than go. I mean, what did you think of Navy food compared to what you were used to at home, perhaps?
Well, it didn't compare to what you had at home. I never felt, but it was adequate. I mean, it sustained life.
Was it what you were used to in the style of food, or was it?
Well, and the way it was dished up. I mean, it was slapped on a plate for you and you went and sat and ate it. It wasn't like at home where you sat at the table and your mum would dish the food out. You know, it's totally different. And quite often, if you were at the end of the queue, it wasn't as hot as it could have been, the food. But it sustained you. I mean, people talk about, in the olden days, the food was terrible, you know, full of weevils and all this, which to me it's a lot of cobblers, because in Nelson's day, them sailors had to work blinking hard, far harder than we did. I mean, they had to climb masts and reef sails and man cannons manually. And they couldn't do that if they wasn't adequately fed. And that's how I felt we were. We were adequately fed to sustain life. But it wasn't special in any shape or form. I never found.
Now, after breakfast, then, say, what sort of training sessions might you have at Royal Arthur?
They were military.
Well, let's start
marching,
with drill then.
Drill.
How did you take? Had you ever been in, I should have asked, the Boys Brigade or the Army Cadets?
No.
So it's your first. How did you take to drill? Because not everyone can do it easily, anyway.
I liked it. It was, you know, organised and precise. some people had a lot of trouble with it. I remember in my squad there was a Scotsman who couldn't swing his arms in time with his legs. And he used to say, swing his right arm forward when his right leg went forward, say. And he looked weird, and they tried everything. They used to strap one arm to his body and make him do it one-handed and no-handed. And oh, they did eventually, before the end of the, I'm not sure if it was 6 or 8 weeks there, got him to march properly. But we did rifle drill. Apart from marching, which was a big thing, to get everybody marching precisely, because any time during your military service you could be called on for parades and all that, and you had to be able to march and march properly. But we did rifle drill. I can't remember firing the rifles at Royal Arthur, but we certainly did at the next place. And then at
PT?
The pardon?
A lot of PT?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that. What type of PT were you
at? At least 2 or 3 times a week we had a session of PT, as we did when we went to the next training establishment.
So what would a session, what types of session? There's lots of different ways of doing PT. Which way were they? Oh,
we used to do the lot. We used to run. We used to do the wall bars. We used to do exercises, because everybody had to touch the toes, which was quite difficult for some people who'd never done it before, especially if you were a bit portly. Even at 16, I mean, some of the blokes were overweight, and I can see them now, you know, PTI pushing them down to get them to touch the toes. Eventually we all did. But they used to take us outside, and part of the camp was on a slope, and we used to have to run up and down the hill as exercise. But all types. We had to do sport. We played indoor football. We had to box each other. And you really had to box, you know. You couldn't sort of powder puff around. You had to thump each other because they made you. And then at the end of...
Now, any weapons training there, or was that later on? Rifle, bayonets?
Well, no, we did rifle drill.
But not actually learning how to shoot.
Not like soldiers.
Any simple seamanship or any other subjects done at Corsham?
No, that was...
So drill and PT is pretty well it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, how did you get on with the other lads? I mean, you know, because there you are, all boys together, all about the same age. Were they from the same sort of background as you? Did you get on with them reasonably well?
Oh, yeah. We were all the same. I mean, some of them, academically, you get the odd grammar school boy who would be accelerated advanced, which means he got promotion fairly quickly. Whereas the bulk of us didn't at that point. I was accelerated later on. But we were all much of a muchness, and we got on. We had to get on.
Did you make any good friends, or was it just acquaintances at that stage? You know how it is.
Well, in the Navy, it was always acquaintances, because you were only perhaps together for 2 years, and then you'd disperse to other ships.
So what about any bullying? Was there any of that?
Not that I can remember.
Now, how did you get on with the instructors? Were they any good?
Well, I mean, they were petty officers, all the instructors, which to us boys were, you know, next to the captain or next to God. But they were, you know, in a different league to us. The instructors, I mean, if they said jump, you jumped. And there was no two ways about it. Or you were punished. You know.
What punishments would they use?
They could send you outside and double up and down the hill till I call you in. Things like that. any other punishment, it had to be official. They would put you on a charge and you'd see the first lieutenant or the commander who would punish you accordingly.
Were they fair, the instructors? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were all Stoker PO. Oh, no. At Royal Arthur, they were mainly seamen, petty officers.
Was there a lot of shouting and swearing, or were they quieter voiced?
They were shouting loudly and fiercely.
Swearing?
Not a terrible lot. I mean, they didn't need to. If they raised the voice, you listened and did, you know.
Did you see much of your officers in that first 6 weeks?
No. Well, every morning we used to parade, and the petty officer would report to the divisional officer that all was correct, you know, and all that. And that was the only time we used to see them, really, the officers. And that applied at the second training camp for the technical training.
Now, were you, I mean, what about, was there a canteen or anything like that?
Yes, there was a canteen. Now, I can't remember drink there, but there must have been, because there was older recruits as well.
But you'd be underage anyway.
But we were underage, so we wouldn't have been allowed. I was made assistant class leader.
Now, what did that mean?
Well, it made you responsible for a lot of things in the block. You know, seeing it was cleaned up for rounds.
Now, so how would you get your kit and your uniform, your kit and your room ready for inspection in? Do you know what I mean? I mean, as much detail as you can remember, because it's a big part
of... Well, in your block, everything had to be stowed away in your locker. Unless you had a kit muster. Now, the block had to be clean and clear for rounds once a day. If you were having to do a kit muster, and they would give you a kit muster if there was something, you know, if they found something wrong with your uniform, you would be ordered a kit muster, and your kit had to be laid out on your hammock, which we were issued with by then. A hammock laid on the floor.
Oh, it was on the floor next to the bunk then?
Next to your bunk. And all your kit would be laid out in a specific order, all folded up neatly with the name showing on each piece of kit. And there was, we had a picture of how it should be. You know, the shoes were at the bottom and various items right going to the top. I think the top was your uniforms and then your kit. And they would come and inspect it to see it was all okay. And that was a big thing.
And what about bull, things like polishing your boots? Was there any...
Oh, yeah. They showed us, the PO, who's our instructor, would show you how to bone your best boots. You know, put polish on and spit on it, and the plastic handle or whatever the handle was on your toothbrush, to press it and do little circles. Because when you were issued with your boots, the toes, well, the whole boot was all crinkly, and you had to iron those crinkles out on the toe of the shoe and or boot. Because we weren't allowed shoes then, we had boots. And we had to get it up to a real gloss. We never managed like the guardsmen, but they had to be shiny. And it was heartbreaking work. I mean, a new pair of boots takes weeks to do.